This is an interview with Dr. Alan Alexander McRae for the Archives of Biblical Theological Seminary by Jim Pakula in Dr. McRae's living room at 200 North Main Street, Hatfield, Pennsylvania, on Wednesday, July 18th at about 11:30 a.m. Dr. McRae, it is a privilege to conduct this first oral history interview with you. I'm excited and enthusiastic about this project. And as I indicated briefly to you, we'd like to begin at the beginning. So I'd like to open this up for you to share as informally and as freely as you like in this relaxed setting of your own living room about your ancestors or parents, your birth and childhood, anything you'd like to share. And I will not interrupt you, except occasionally maybe to ask for a clarification or to prompt a particular response or something of that sort.
Very good. It is indeed an interesting coincidence that when Biblical Theological Seminary was founded in Hatfield, Pennsylvania, the two co-founders should have been born in the same little town in northern Michigan. Both Dr. Murray and I were born in Calumet, Michigan. Now, Calumet, Michigan, early in the present century, was not an incorporated city. It was rather a group of villages, although I heard it said that if these villages had been grouped together and made into a city, that it would have been the sixth largest in Michigan at that time. It was a mining community, and that had much to do with the general situation that developed. It's quite different from any other kind of a place. But first, a word about the weather. It is on a little peninsula that juts out about 75 miles into Lake Superior. And my mother used to say that we had 9 months of winter and 3 months of late fall. Whether that's quite true, I don't know, but I must say the summers are as beautiful and lovely there as one can possibly imagine. And the winters, it did not get terribly cold, but the average temperature was quite chilly, and we had a great deal of snow. And in those days, they did not plow their roads at winter. And so when along in September or October, when the snow began to come, we would put aside our cars, the few people who had them, and get out the horses and the sleighs. And the road that I would follow to go to school, the snow used to get packed down 6 or 7 feet high, and it would get packed very solid where the road was. And then the fresh snow would come over it and cover the fields to the sides, and it was a little difficult to be sure just where the road was, but if your sleigh got too far to the right when you were meeting someone, it might get into the soft snow, and it would turn over. I don't know if that happened often, but it was always in our minds as a possibility. Now, as I say, it was a series of little villages. Calumet was the headquarters of the Calumet and Hecla Copper Company, and what we spoke of as Calumet proper consisted of the main offices of the company. Its headquarters was in Boston, but its main offices were there. And incidentally, mentioning Boston reminds me of something I'll mention, though it doesn't belong here. When I was in high school, there was a minister from Boston who came to a church there for a time, and we invited him to lunch. And one day, and he walked down through the deep snow, and the icicles were all over his beard when he came in. And he had lunch with us. And then he wrote an article for the Boston paper. Well, now, it just happened that a good friend of mine and I, both of whom had been taking Latin, had that day taken a notion to be looking into the Latin Bible, and we were doing that when he came. And his article, which came out in the Boston paper, said that Calumet was a true extension of Boston, that even the high school students were reading the Latin Bible for recreation. Really, it was interesting. But there was an interesting general atmosphere there, quite nice. There was very little crime. There was quite a bit of drunkenness. And what crime there would be largely a matter through the drunkenness. There were a great many saloons in Calumet. I mentioned that Calumet proper had the headquarters, the local headquarters of Calumet Heckler Company, otherwise just residences. And about half a mile west from it was what we called Red Jacket, which was quite a shopping area, while about half a mile east of it was Lorium. And Lorium also had something of a shopping district in it, though they all in the broad sense were considered part of Calumet. And it was in Lorium that Jack Murray was born, and that he was brought up. Then if you would go about three quarters of a mile north, you would come to the tiny area known as Centennial. And that was where my father was the mine physician.
May I ask a question at that point? Thing. Was your father the physician for the segment of the mine that was at Centennial, what was his relationship to the Calumet and Hecla mining company?
I believe Centennial had originally been a separate mining company, but it had been taken over by the Calumet and Hecla. So I think he was probably of the Centennial Company originally, but then he was one of the group of doctors, sizable group of doctors, that worked for the Calumet and Heckler Company. And though he would primarily take care of people from Centennial Mine, he also had quite a few patients from other mines. And there was a hospital in Lorium, a hospital in Calumet, and a hospital in a smaller sense, a more local sense, and a hospital in Tamarack, which was beyond Red Jacket. And he had patients in all three of these hospitals. He had something of a private practice in addition to his company practice. But it's interesting when you think of it that his company practice, any employee of the company who was single would pay, I believe, $1 a month. And any who was married would pay for his whole family $1.50 a month. This would go to the doctor, and then they would get all the medical service they might need or wish during the month for that small payment. And, of course, he had a little office, a small building that served as an office half a mile, no less than that, quarter of a mile, I guess, from the house. And there, every afternoon, 5 to 6, he and my aunt, who was a nurse, dispensed medicine. But most of what he did was in house calls, except, of course, for operations in the hospital. He did every kind of thing. He even pulled teeth. He said once he had, I think, as many as 3,000 children he brought into the world. And he performed just about any kind of operation you can think of. Of course, there's a great deal known about medicine now that wasn't known in those days. But I think he was a rather well-trained doctor. He had originally 2 years at each of two different hospitals. I think he got his degree from the University of Michigan. And then later on, he went to Jefferson Medical for a year, and University of Chicago for a year for postgraduate work. When he graduated medicine, he was 23 and looked 17. Someone advised him to grow a beard so he wouldn't look like such a child. And at first, I think he had a disadvantage through his youth, but he was very capable, extremely skillful in most anything he set his hands to. And I think, soon won the confidence of people. At first, he was in a little mining town 20 miles north of Centennial called Central Mine, one of the earliest mines in that area. And then when that closed down 4 or 5 years before I was born, they moved from there up to Centennial. Central Mine is now a ghost town. And there still are maybe 30 or 40 houses there. All but 3 or 4 of them are empty. And there is the houses are getting run down, but there is a church which is kept in first-class condition. And every summer, they have a reunion. And even though Central Mine closed in, I believe, 1898, they still have a reunion with a great many people coming back. I suppose today they'd nearly all be children of the people who had been in Central Mine in 06.
Now, was Central Mine part of the Centennial Mining Company?
No, I don't know. Well, I guess it was an independent company. It was before I was born, of course, that it went out of business.
Now, would you like to, at this point, go into how he got from the University of Chicago to
yes.
Central Mine, or
yes.
would you rather
yes.
hold that? Or?
A word on that would be of interest. He was born in Canada, and I never knew anything about his background up there except that he had gone to Lucknow High School. Then when I was in Scotland about 30 years ago, I happened to mention that his ancestors came from Scotland. And they said, "Oh, he must be from Tintail." They said that's where most of the McCrays live. Well, I went to a little port city called Lochalsh, and very few miles inland from this was Tintail, and there is a castle today, an old castle which has been restored, the McCray Castle. And they have in front of it a monument with the names of 400 McCrays who were in the World War I, many in the British Army, in the Canadian, in the American, in the from New Zealand and Australia, and even some in the German Army. And all these people listed, and it interested me to see that out of these 400 or so, 95% of them were spelled the way we spell our name. But the others had about 7 or 8 different spellings, even including McGrath, which is a corruption of McCray. The spelling we use is the one there. But my mother used to say, nobody can spell our name correctly. When she said, I'll go to a store and I'll spell the name, and they'll always write it wrong. Even when I spell it to them, they'll write it down wrong. When I was in Germany, I was at a particular disadvantage because McCray, the first syllable ends in a C, and there's no German syllable ends in a C. If it does, there's always a K after it. And there's no German name that I know of with a capital in the middle of the name, as mine does. And if there is a C in a German word, as I said, it's always followed by a K, and there's no name there that ends in an A-E. And so I never could get people to get the name right. And one time I was going for a little hiking trip, and I bought a hiking suit, and they were to do a little repair and bring it to me, deliver it to me in time. And I said, now you spell this correctly, M-A-C, capital R, A-E. And she wrote that and underlined the capital R, and it was supposed to be delivered to me by 3 o'clock because I was leaving at 4. And 3 o'clock in the afternoon came, no suit. And I waited and waited and waited, and finally, just before 4, a man rapped at the door. I had a room in an apartment, and there were maybe 200 or 300 apartments in the building. And this man came to the door, and he said, "Does Mr. Rawl live here?" And they had my name as Max Rawl, capital R-A-L. And he said, I went all over this place asking for him. Finally, somebody said, there's a foreigner lives up in such and such a place. Maybe that's he. So it's, but the, I was mentioning how in Scotland, this man, this person over there said the McCrays live in Kintail. Mostly, though I met some also in Lochalsh, where we stayed for a couple of days. And they said Nadal just came from Teal. Well, the next year we were in Canada, and I happened to look on the map, and I saw Lucknow, the place where my father went to high school. And a mile and a half in one direction from it was a place called Kintail, and a mile in the other direction was a place called Luhalsh. So there was pretty good proof that that's really where he came from. But when he was, I believe, 16...
Which province of Canada would that have been?
Ontario province. And when he was 16 or 17, he went to... he had a cousin, I guess it was. No, there was a sister of his mother who lived in Lake Linden, which is just a very few miles from Calumet. He was what they call surface boss of the Quincy mine there. And he went there and attended high school and lived with these folks. And then he went to the University of Michigan, and he naturally came back to that area. And this was a few miles from Central Mine. And so that's how he got started there. And he spent all his working life in that area. But he was a very, very industrious man. And he was always, when my mother came there to live with him, he told her, now don't you tell anybody how much work I'm doing. They would take away a lot of it from me. Because he worked on, he did such a tremendous lot of work. And she said, when he'd have a little time free, he would spend it studying history or some other subject. He was always studying if he wasn't actually working.
Now, why did she go to live with him?
Well, that's another story. Maybe we better leave her a little later.
Fine.
But he was, as I say, he was very industrious and always interested in any kind of a subject, and a very, very hard worker. He was was very modest. Once he gave a paper on filing to the American Medical Association, and he practiced that over 30 times before he gave it. And he was so modest that it didn't get anything like the response that I think it would, because he was so very modest. But he really did work very, very hard. One thing about a mining area like that is there's always a big interest in finance, because with mines there's so much about one failing and getting a bonanza and another and so on. And in this little town there, they must have had 6 or 7 brokerage houses. And they didn't have the, things weren't as organized as they are today. He told me that he would go to one company and he would say, will you please buy me on credit some shares of certain stock? And they'd say, well, have you got collateral? He'd say, sure. He'd pull out a certificate for so much stock he owned in some company, and they would give it to him. Then he would go over to another one, and he'd ask them to buy something. He'd pull out the same certificate and show it to them. Nowadays, you'd have to have your certificate deposited with them to do anything like that. But there was tremendous interest there in speculation and in investments, probably more than most other types of towns of the same size. When I was about to... I was 8 or 10, I guess. He was taking an interest in a copper mine down in New Mexico called the Chino Copper Company, and he read everything he could on it, investigated. Up there in Michigan, he'd go down in the mine sometimes and see how conditions were. I remember one mine. I was told that they didn't want him to go down there because the mine was getting played out, and he would recognize it. But he studied this Chino mine, he told everybody about it, and he bought, he said to me, now he says, I want to get you some stock in the Chino mine. So he, for some years, every time I had a little extra money, a few dollars, something, I'd give it to him, and it was put into the little stock he had for me in the Chino mine. And the Chino was anywhere from $16 to $20 a share, and it went back and forth that way for 8 or 10 years. And finally, it began to take off, and it went up to 63. And it went to 63, he said. Well, he says, if it gets to 63.5, I'm going to sell. So he put in order to sell at 63.5, but the next day it was down to 60, and it went on down. He finally sold it again at 18, which was just about what he paid for it originally. So the few dollars I had saved through those years, I didn't get back. He said, get on even. But that's quite unimportant. We don't want that in the final of this. But I thought it might be of interest.
Well, no, that's fascinating.
You think it is?
Yes, indeed. Yes.
Now, I was going to mention.
About his getting from University of Chicago up to the Calumet area.
Well, you see, his uncle lived there. And he lived there in high school. So he went back to the area where he had gone in high school.
I see. Lucknow High School was in
That
Canada.
Was in Ontario.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know how long he went there. But he had at least a year or two in Lake Linden High School, which was right near Calumet.
I see.
And it was, I've never heard much about those days of his life. He was always much more interested in discussing some scholarly subject than telling me much about himself, about his background.
That sounds like my father. Yeah. Now, you don't know why he went to live with his uncle?
I don't know whether the family was having hard time making ends meet up there on their farm in Canada, or whether there was a better school in this particular place. I never heard any reason.
But your grandparents were in the Lucknow area in Ontario on a farm originally.
They lived in a farm in that area somewhere, yes. Yes.
And that would have...
And incidentally... Not only maybe 20 years ago, I met my father's last surviving brother just shortly before his death in California, and he told me that he had heard that his grandfather was a British soldier in India, and that they had been given land in Canada to these soldiers, and that would fit with the name Lucknow, which is named doubtless after an important city in India.
Hmm.
And my uncle told me that he understood that his grandfather was supposed to have had some money or valuable things buried out in back of the house somewhere, and that after his death they searched everywhere, but they never found him. He told me, my father incidentally was a little bit of a fellow. He never, I think he weighed only 90 when he died, and he never weighed over 130 in his life. He was short, only came about to my shoulder. But when he was in his last few years, when we lived in California, he would come out, he would tell me to go and do some hoeing. And I would start hoeing, and I would be doing some. And he would come out and say, oh, you're not covering ground. Look here. He'd take the hoe, and he'd go up and down that row so fast I could hardly keep up to him. But after a few minutes, he was tired out and quit. Let me go on again. But he always did things rapidly like that. He was quite skillful, and he invested money in his brother who had wandered through the West for years, Brother Charles. And he invested this money to enable his brother to get land in Montana, and they called it McRae Brothers Company. And my father would go out there every year or two to see how it was coming. When I was about 8 years old, he took me with him to Montana. We visited my mother's brother in Helena, the capital, where he had a store, grocery store, and we went on to this little town of Woodside, just south of Missoula. And at that time, his brother had a big apple orchard. We brought back a big trunk all full of apples from it. And that Bitterroot Valley is right on the edge of Montana next to Idaho. I made two later visits in my teens to it, and it was a lovely area. I used to ride around there on horseback, and I surely loved it.
Now, your father going from Lucknow
to Lake Linden.
Would it have been Lake Linden, Michigan?
Yep.
Which was right near Calumet.
Right near Calumet.
And that would have been his father's brother? Or
no,
his mother's brother.
This was
the uncle.
His mother's sister.
I see.
His mother's sister.
And her husband
her
lived
husband
over there.
Her husband lived there. Yeah.
I see.
I don't know how they came to get there. They had a big family. And maybe 15 years ago, I visited there, and the one remaining member of the family, little elderly lady, was so happy to see me. I reminded her so much of my father, who I guess she had known pretty well when they both were teenagers there. Yeah.
So, your father had how many siblings then?
Oh, he had a big family. I think a couple of them died when he was young. And
it was Charles.
Charles was a great big fellow. And Lockie was the last one of the boys, and my father used to love when he'd see Lockie to say, oh, I remember the day he was born. I was 4 years old, something like that. And Lockie always felt a little embarrassed when he said that. Lockie became a mining engineer, as you would expect of somebody who lived in Michigan there for a while. And he used to travel for the Phelps Dodge Company in Mexico. He told me he would go with mules and go way off in the back country looking at possible mines that Phelps Dodge might be interested in buying. He said he'd go for months off into the country. Then he said he would send his information about the companies to Phelps Dodge, and he would never know whether they went further with it, whether they took an interest, whether they sent a higher expert, whether they bought the place, or whether they just disregarded it. But evidently they thought enough of his work that I guess for 30 years he did that work. And when finally he retired and moved to California, he would go to the Roman Catholic Church simply on the chance he might meet a Mexican there. And somebody asked him once if he wanted to go to heaven. Oh, he says, the only place I want to go is back to Mexico.
This was your uncle, and how did you spell his name?
L-A-C-H-I-E. Lachie, I believe.
And that was the youngest brother. The
youngest brother. I believe it's an abbreviation of Lachlan, L-A-C-H-L-A-N-T. So I don't know a great deal about that.
And what was your father's full name then?
John was all the name he had.
Just the two names. And he had an older brother, Charles?
A younger.
So Charles and Lockie were both younger.
Yeah. Lockie was not very big, but bigger than my father. Charles was a great big fellow. And I think it was Lockie told me how up in Canada on the farm, the boys, I don't know how many boys there were, but they would lie in this one bed. And he said Charles, who was big, though younger than John, would make a big racket. And of course, they didn't have any lights then, unless they were the kerosene lamps. And he said that he would be making this big racket, and their father would come running up the stairs, and he would, in order, he knew it was Charles who did it, he would come up there to get Charles, punish him, and Charles would immediately grab John and push him when he heard his father coming and put him in his place, and he moved into Charles' place. So the father would grab John, pull him up, and spank him, and put him back upstairs. So I guess my father had kind of a tough time of it.
Now, there was, were there any other brothers? Was your father the oldest surviving brother? Or?
There was Alec, too. There was Alec. And I knew his two sons.
Was he younger?
Alec, my father was the oldest. And Lockie, I think, was the youngest. And where Alec came, I don't know. Alec was the physician in the Osceola mine, which was maybe 4 or 5 miles from us. And one day, when his oldest son was maybe 3 or 4 years old, he went to go to his office at office time, the late afternoon, and he went down to the basement, and he had turned, electric lights were comparatively new then, and he had turned it on from up above, and when he would leave, he would just unwind it, I think. Anyway, there was something wrong, and he got a shock. And he'd never showed up in the office. And so eventually they hunted downstairs and found him dead there.
This was Alec?
This was Alec.
Oh.
I never saw him. This was...
So about how old was he when he died?
Well...
He was a young physician.
He was a young physician.
Oh.
And 40 years later, I visited in Central Mine about 10, 12 years ago. I guess I'd be late, more than 40. And I came by one of those houses, and there was a man sitting out in the front porch. And I spoke to him, and I said, I was the son of Dr. McRae. Why, he says, there are two Dr. McRae's. There's Dr. John, and there's Dr. Alec. Which are you? And I gave him the news that Alec had died, I guess, 40 or 50 years after he had. But it was unfortunate. Alec left two boys and without a father. And mother was something of an invalid, and I don't know, may have been sort of, I don't know, easygoing, chronically thinking herself ill or what, but the two boys were not brought up the way they should have been. Wendell, he loved the other fellows in the school and didn't work particularly hard, but he had a good brain. And he was in the First World War, he was in a camp, and they never sent him overseas, but he was in this camp for, I guess, a year or more. And he told me, when he got out of the camp, he said he was so disgusted with authority, he wouldn't take anybody's orders from anybody. And he said he would get a job, and he would be in it a year or two, and he would, the boss would say, oh, why don't you do it this way? He'd say, oh, I'll take your job, and he'd quit. And he said, and there were plenty of jobs, because he said that after the jobs gradually had got so that instead of his only lasting a day or two, he might last a month or two. But he said it kept, the time kept increasing that he would have a particular job. And finally, one day, he was driving taxi in Washington, D.C., and it was raining, and he sat there and he said, oh, he got kind of disgusted with this kind of life. And he said he heard that there were special opportunities for veterans. So he went and he got trained as as an Internal Revenue Inspector. And the rest of his life, he had a pretty good position.
Before we flip the tape, we'll go on then. He had a brother, the other son, the other orphan.
His brother, Leland, Wendell was a year or two older than I was. Oh, and incidentally, my father's cousin there, they had a son named Alan Jones. And Alan Jones and Wendell were of about an age. And when they were in high school or younger, my father used to think it was a big joke that one of them detested milk and the other detested cream. And so he said when they'd come to dinner, he'd say to one of them, would you like some cream? Oh, fine. The other, do you want some milk? And he'd give it to them out of the same pitcher, and they both were happy, he said. But
they'd come over. This was your father who said that?
Yeah, my father was
his uncle, and they would come to your house some...
Well, not uncle, it was cousin.
Well, I mean, it was their uncle. Your father was their uncle.
My father's mother was the sister of their grandmother.
Of Wendell and...
Of Alan Jones's grandmother. Wendell's father was my father's brother. Yes. There were the two sons, Wendell and Leland.
I'm sorry, yeah.
Yes, and Leland was younger and also not the firstborn. And so from the difficulty of being brought up, I mentioned, he suffered more than the other. And we had the general impression of him as not amounting to much. And we had that general impression all through, even when I had begun to be in college. He had moved to California too by that time. But then, eventually, he married a nice woman. I never saw her, but a very fat woman, I understand. And he became a motion picture operator. And he stayed at it. And he was, in his later years, he had the pick. He had the seniority in the union. So he had the pick of any job of that type in Los Angeles, I think. But his wife, I don't know, she felt rather possessive of him, and we never even saw her. And then when she died, he married her sister. And the cousins had told me that they just weren't able to get any information about his last years. But he did become very, very active in Christian witness in his later years and distributed tracts quite a bit. And I have the impression that, on the whole, I'd say that he turned out really very well, not what one would have expected. While Wendell turned out all right, but Wendell, with his far more attractive personality and everything, you would have thought he would have done much better than he did. The war seems to have been a bad effect on him. He told me, I think he was, when he was in college, he went up to North Dakota one summer and got a job on that, in a farm. And he said the first day, first place he worked, he said he was fired because he didn't know how to harness a horse. But he said after that summer, he said he could harness any horse in pitch darkness.
Well, there were the four boys then, John, Charles, Alec, and Lockie.
There were those, yeah. Then there were a number of girls.
I see.
Yeah.
And you've discussed two cousins, the two sons of Alec. Are there any other cousins that you wanted, Charles or Lockie's or any of the girls? Children that you wanted to mention before we move on?
These were the only first cousins. These two boys were the only first cousins.
Of yours?
Of mine.
Charles Lockie or the girls have any children?
Yes, they...
Who would have been first cousins, too?
Yes. Charles had no children. Lockie never married. Who's the other one? Alec had the two boys.
Right, and the girls.
And
their sisters.
None of the girls had children.
Really? How many girls were there? Do you remember their names? Would be your aunt.
Yeah, Aunt Mary, we had a lot to do with when I was a little child. Aunt Mary. And also, the way mother's sister, Aunt Mary, lived with us until I was entered college. And his sister was Aunt Mary. And then there was Aunt Belle. And Belle became a teacher. And she eventually landed up in Aspen, Colorado, which in those days was just a little former mining town, a little ghost town. And she married a farmer there.
Now, was that the Aunt Belle that you took care of in the late 60s? Wasn't there an Aunt Belle at Faith that lived with you?
That was my wife's aunt.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, so you both had an Aunt Belle.
We both had an Aunt Belle.
And who were the other girls besides Mary and Belle?
There was a Jane, whom I only knew as a little boy. And I don't know whether there were more or not.
Now, why are they somewhat obscure? Did none of them ever really marry or ever move to Michigan?
They were all in Michigan. Eventually they all came. But I was pretty young then, and I left Michigan when I was 13.
I see. So if they did have children, you haven't kept contact with their family?
I'm sure I had no other first cousin.
Isn't that so?
Yes, it is.
Did some of them...
The same was true on my mother's side. My mother was one of... she had one sister and two brothers, and she's the only one who had children of the four.
Now, what was her maiden name, her full name?
Well, should we...
Or do you want to...
Should we complete father before we...
I'm sorry.
Or is there... Is
no,
there,
you're
have
right.
Have we covered everything?
Well, I'm wondering about... your father had an uncle who lived... It was his mother's sister and her husband.
Yeah, yes. And his name was Alan McIntyre.
Alan McIntyre?
Alan McIntyre. And when I was, what?
Is it T-Y-R-E?
I think it's T-Y-R-E. It's M-A-C, I believe. Capital I-N-T-Y-R-E. Alan McIntyre. I never knew him. He was before my time. But he was what they called surface boss. And he seems to... And incidentally, another connection. This Calumet and Heckler Mining Company, the headquarters were in Boston. And I believe it was one of the Agassiz, yes, Alexander Agassi, I think was president of the company for a time, I'm not sure. But I don't know whether it was his wife's brother or some close relation like that, that also was at the time head of the company. And his son became a member of the Bible Evangelism Board here.
That's right. Dr. Murray has mentioned that connection.
Yes, and when I went to Dr. Murray's, was it 25th anniversary or something like that, at his house, I got there. He said, your father was mine physician for the Calumet and Heckler. Here's the man that owned the company, whose father owned the company. Well, that's not quite it, but he was prominent in this and probably owned a lot of it.
I see.
I forget his name at the moment, but very nice chap.
So your father went over to Lake Linden to live with Uncle Alan McIntyre.
Alan McIntyre, whom I never saw. And Alan...
And from there he decided to go to college and medical school and then eventually return there to practice.
Return to that area, general area, but it's maybe 10 or 15 miles away.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And Alan McIntyre had a lot of children, hardly any of whom had children themselves, again. Hmm. And of his children, there was a Bell. This was Aunt Bell when I was a boy with this one. Bell McIntyre married John E. Jones. And she had a sister, Sadie McIntyre, and brother Charlie and Dan, another brother, all those big family of the McIntyres. And as they say, old Charlie had one daughter and one son. And that's all of the McIntyres that of their children had any children, except Belle Jones. Belle, who married the dentist, Dr. Jones, who died before I was born. But we used to visit them in Lake Linden a great deal. And they had, the Joneses had three girls and a boy.
Now, who are the Joneses again?
Alan McIntyre's daughter, Belle, married John E. Jones, who was a dentist, but died before I was born, I believe, leaving her with three girls who were about my age and a son who was slightly older than I was. And we used to visit back and forth with them a great deal. I knew them better than any other relative.
These, of course, would be your father's cousin and her children.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes.
And they lived in that area right there.
They lived in Lake Linden.
Were these the only people on either side of the family at that time when your father went there to live with his aunt and uncle? Was the McIntyres, were there other relatives?
There is a family. What is the name? I can't think of the name. Oh, McLean. You see, my father's mother was a McLean. And there was a McLean family that was there too, that I never knew when they were there. But years later, when I went to seminary, I went to the Canadian Rockies and took the Canadian Pacific and then came into Princeton. And I was going to visit a friend I'd known in California named Gutsky. You may have heard of him.
Yes.
Yes.
At Columbia?
Yes.
Columbia.
He taught in Columbia. Well, I'd known Gutsky, and he was going to teach in, he was a pastor of one of the Continuing Presbyterian Church of Canada. He was just a young fellow, hadn't been to seminary yet, but he was pastor of this new church. And I said I would visit him there. And my mother said, don't say anything to your father, you're going to Winnipeg. He'd want you to visit all his relatives. I said nothing about it, but just shortly before we left, happened to mention, some mention of Winnipeg came out. My father says, oh, you're going to Winnipeg. Well, he says, if you're there, look up. Now, I forget the initial, R.D., I think it was. He said, look up R.D. McLean. He's the bookkeeper at Hudson's store. So I got to Canada, to Winnipeg, and Manfred Gutsky met me at the train. But he said his wife was just expecting their first child. So he took me to the home of a woman in his church instead of to his home. And now he said, tomorrow I have a course at the University of Manitoba. But he said, can you come downtown on the streetcar? And he said, I'll meet you. I got to Canada, to Winnipeg, and Manfred Gutsky met me at the train. But he said his wife was just expecting their first child. So he took me to the home of a woman in his church instead of to his home. And now he said, tomorrow I have a course at the University of Manitoba. But he said, can you come downtown on the streetcar? And he said, I'll meet you in the lobby of Eaton's store. I said, Eaton's store? My father said, I should look up H.R. McLean, who's the bookkeeper of Eaton's store. He says, the bookkeeper? He says, Eaton's store is the biggest store in Western Canada. He says, they've probably got 50 bookkeepers. He says, there's some mistake there. He says, it's a different store or something, he said. So the next day I went into there to meet him, and I asked where the bookkeeping department was, up on the 9th floor. So I took the elevator up, and I came out, and here this very official-looking man saw me, and he's coming there, and he says, were you looking for a job, he says. I said, no. I said, I was looking for R.D. McLean, the bookkeeper of Eaton's store. Well, he says, I'm R.D. McLean. But he said, I'm in charge of the whole store. He was a complete director of the whole store, so the term bookkeeper was a little bit anomalous. I had a good chat with him. And
that was your mother's brother?
No, that was my father's second cousin, I think.
Your father's mother's side.
Her side, but I don't know the exact
relationship. I see. Uh-huh. Yeah. What was her name, her maiden name, your grandma?
Yes, she was Jane McLean. Jane McLean. And you see, she had another sister, Belle, who was in Lake Linden, was Belle McIntyre.
That would have been your mother, with Jane McLean.
My father's mother.
Oh, of course. Excuse me. Yes.
Yes.
Okay. And your father's father was, what was his name? Of course it was McRae.
Yes. My father said his father was John McRae, his father John McRae, and his father's John McRae, and that's as far back as he knew.
And they were still in Canada at that point. That would have been his great-grandfather.
No, I don't think any of them were in Canada up till his father. I think his father was, his grandfather, I believe, was a member of the British Army in India. So I'm a bit hazy on that.
I see.
And my uncle, when I was on a debating tour and we debated at Grand Forks, North Dakota, my father wrote me, and he says, when you were at Fargo, look up my father's brother who was there. Well, I wasn't at Fargo, I was in Grand Forks. So I made no effort to look him up because that'd be some miles away.
Sure.
And we were rather didn't have time. When I got back, he said, any relatives of your father's brother? Your grandfather's brother. And I said, I wasn't in Fargo. He said, Fargo. He said, I say Fargo, I meant Grand Forks. So I was right there. And then just before Uncle Lockie died 30 years later, he told me that another brother of his father had gone to California, and there's a town about 50 miles from Los Angeles called Ontario, which would fit with their coming from Ontario. And he said he had been there, his uncle, but he said he had only daughters, so the names disappeared. So.
But then as far as you know, your father, your grandfather, your great-grandfather, and your great-great-grandfather were all John McCrae.
All John McCrae, yes.
I see. And your great-grand...
Oh, and my father's father's father married a Murchison, M-U-R-C-H-I-S-O-N. And, you know, there now are Murchisons in Texas who are tremendously wealthy and powerful. But... I don't know any of Murchisons now, but when I was at Kintail, I found that out of maybe 700 people, maybe 500 were McCrays and 200 were Murchisons. So that fit.
Huh. How did your grandfather get to Canada then, if his father was possibly in India at one time?
No. Well, the British Army, after the uprisings about 1850 in Canada, in which Lucknow was one of the most important places involved in that, when those soldiers came back to Britain and they were ushered out, instead of giving them pensions, they gave them land in Canada, I believe. And that would be how he came to come to Canada.
I see.
Yeah.
So, but they weren't over in the North American continent then at that point.
In 1850?
Yes.
No, I would guess they came in maybe 1880, 70, something like that. I don't know.
So your father's grandparents probably were the ones that came from Scotland.
I would guess my father's father was there. No, you're right. My father's grandparents would be the ones probably who came from Scotland.
And about the 1850s? Or so,
a little later. I think the uprising... The Sikh uprising in India, I think, was about 1850, if I recall correctly. So I would think might be the late 50s or might be a little later. He might have continued in the army 10 years before he was ushered out. I don't know.
But it was his father that married the Murchison.
Yes.
And that would have been in Scotland.
That would have been in Scotland.
But when they got over here, these names appear. So there could have been a group that came at that time to Canada.
I have never met any Murchisons. In America.
So this was all in Scotland.
I met a number of them in Scotland.
And this town of, was there a town of Murchison?
No, the town is called Kintail, K-I-N-T-A-L.
But there were a lot of families of both McCrae and Murchison.
The bulk were McCrae's, but the rest were Murchison's. And when I was there about 20 years ago, 30 years ago, there was an old man who could hardly hear. I preached there. And he had heard from the Murchisons in Texas, and they wanted to know about their ancestors. And so he had compiled a genealogy of all the Murchisons. And he wanted me to come over to his house and see it. And I went over, and here he had all these Murchisons with their relations and everything and all about them. And I began to look at it. And his son or son-in-law, who was there, thought it was kind of foolish to bother. And I said, the old man could hardly hear. And I said, well, I can hardly digest all this. I said, at one sitting, I said, I just don't know where to look in this. And he said, well, he says, take it to your room and look it over there. The son or son-in-law, whatever he was, said. And I said to the old man, could I take this and look at it? And he immediately became terribly frightened, as if I was trying to steal his valuable genealogy. Oh, mine on from then. He kind of held on to the thing, and I wasn't greatly interested. And the result was that I really remember nothing of the thing. He was so anxious to show me, but so afraid I would run off with it. So that was really fun.
That's K-A-N-T-A-L-E?
K-I-N-T-A-I-L.
So that goes back
want to trace the ancestry of the Murchisons, you must read who is the famous Johnson again, the English writer?
Well, there's Samuel Johnson, James Boswell.
Yeah, that one. Samuel Johnson and James Boswell made a trip to the Hebrides, the islands east of islands west of Scotland, and Johnson wrote a famous book on a journey to the Hebrides, and in the course of it he tells how up in northern Scotland there one morning somebody says, oh look, there come the wild Macraes. And that's all I know about the Macraes from that side. But the word Macrae seems to me originally son of grace, and seems to have been an ecclesiastical word. That seems to be grace in the biblical sense, seems to be the origin of the name. So my wife used to say my son is son of grace in three different ways.
Well, do you want to develop any more the your father's odyssey then into college or?
I don't know much about him in those early days. He was tremendously interested in people, greatly interested in people. And when we went to California, he was avid for any news of Michigan. And one day my mother said one day, he says, Eunice, do you remember that man that wore such and such a hat used to walk past the lawn? She says, no, I don't. What's this? No, he wore such and such a suit and so on. He used to come by at least once a week. No. What about him? I just heard he died. And that was his interest constantly in any news from there. So he had a sort of an interest in individual history, which I have always had, but which my mother, I don't think, had so. And I don't know, I never had anything like the extent that he had. I mentioned how modest he was. And one time in California, we received word that his mother had died. He had retired. He had early retirement because of completely broken health. And he was there in California and received news that his mother had died at a telegram. And my mother said, well, so you're not going back to Michigan, are you? You're not going way back there for the funeral. No. So I just got up to him. Well, then they were out in the auto and they heard a train whistle. And he said, in another 2 hours, that train goes. The last train to get me there in time for the funeral. And if I'm not on that train, I'm just going to collapse. So she said, well, we'll have to hustle and try to get you on it. So they rushed home, got some other clothes on, and threw some stuff in the trunk, and rushed down to the railroad station in town 6 miles away from us through city streets. And she went in and got him a ticket on the train, a ticket as far as Calumet. You had to go 3 days on the train to Chicago, 3 days and three nights, I believe, and then it was overnight up to 400 miles up to Calumet. But they didn't think of expenses on rock. So he was on the train, and he got hungry. And he went into the diner and asked for And he said to them, we didn't think to bring any money. I have no money with me. But he said, I have absolutely sufficient that I could easily pay you later. And the conductor looked at him very suspiciously, and the dining car. And, he was very skeptical, and he went on explaining. And then the man says, well, he says, I'll take a chance on it. Well, that hurt his feelings. He couldn't have anybody take a chance on it. So he says, no, he says, if you can't trust me, he says, that's it. So he went back, and he had 3 days without a bite to eat on the train. And then got to Chicago and had to walk into Michigan. And he got up there, and it was the middle of a big blizzard, snow 5-6 feet high, blowing snow. And it was a wonderful thing for him because it cured him of a longing to get back to the place where he'd spend his life. After that, he was happy to be in California. But it was a tough thing to go through. But I mean, that was a quality which I probably share to quite an extent.
Now, whose death was that?
His mother.
I see.
With quality which I probably...
Jane McLean McRae.
Yeah. I probably share to quite an extent. I hate to ask anybody for any favor. Hate to, if there's the slightest chance getting turned on. I even hate to ask anybody where a street is in a strange city. And I guess he had the same as I have that way. But it is a foolish... Now, when I was in college, I remember two fellows told how they got on the train, and they didn't have any money, and they said, well, we'll have to use our lodges. One of them was an elk, I guess, and the other was another one, so they went through the train looking for people with that, and asking them to tie them over. I got on the train once, and I had run out of money in Utah. In Salt Lake City, no, it's in Las Vegas, Nevada, and I had 2 or 3 days to get to Chicago, and my money was practically nothing, and I wondered if I'd have enough to eat, at least eat as much as I'd like, and I walked through the train, as I always did, and when I got 3 or 4 cars back of the car I was in, fellow says, oh, Dr. McRae, how are you? And he was a teacher in Eastern Baptist, which I had met once. And so we chatted a little, and I told him of my problem, and he advanced me $10. And then when we landed in Chicago, Wendell McRae was there at the train to meet me, so I got the 10 from him and immediately repaid this fellow.
The Lord took care of you on that.
It's amazing how he did it. And in my father's case, I don't know, his health was terrible in those days. And my mother used to say he had 4 various illnesses, any one of which would kill an ordinary man. He was an invalid for 15 or 20 years there before he died.
He was no longer practicing.
Oh, he had to quit one. He lost his health completely at 53. But I would say that he did, by the time he was 53, he had expended as much energy as I did by the time I was 8 or more. Oh, the rate he went at, I couldn't do it. That tremendous energy. And a tremendous brain. But one time I remember how he amused me, because... in California there, we walked down the street, and he and I were walking down there, and he said, let's go into the bank here and see what the manager so-and-so thinks about economic conditions. So we stepped into the bank. This manager was very polite, friendly. My father says, what do you think of the economic condition of the country? Well, the fellow says, I don't know what you think. And then he started and talking rapidly for 10 minutes, telling what he thought of that. Then he said, what do you think of world conditions? And I said, well, they're sort of confused. What do you think about it? He talked for about 10 minutes, telling his ideas of that. We went on. He said, what a nice conversation.
Well, how did he decide to, after graduating from Lake Linden High School, to go to college and then into medicine?
I've never heard. Never heard. I've often wished since that I had asked him more about his early life and everything. But when I was in Princeton Seminary, he would be so anxious to hear all the news about everything. And if I had some of my friends from college or from seminary and we'd get together, he was so anxious to hear everything he said. But when he and I'd be alone, we'd be driving downtown. He was blind by that time. He would say, what street is this? Oh, he'd say, there's a drugstore on the corner there, isn't there? Now, what's on the other corner? And he wanted to know just what was in each street, and, you know, and so on. And he just didn't seem to have time to try for me.
This is an interview with Dr. Alan Alexander McRae for the Archives of Biblical Theological Seminary by Jim Pakula in Hatfield, Pennsylvania, in Dr. McRae's living room at the seminary on Thursday, July 19, 1984, at about 4:30 in the afternoon. Well, Dr. McRae, good afternoon. It's good to pick up where we left off yesterday. We were talking about your father, John McRae, who was born, I understand, as we've just been chatting for a minute, in Ontario,
in the province.
The province of Ontario, Canada, in 1861. Would you like to, we did cover a bit about his life yesterday. Would you like to mention his college, medical school, and postgraduate work, and then his coming to Centennial, and then maybe comment on the people of that area.
My father lived in Canada until he was, I believe, about 17, perhaps 15, I don't know for sure. And then he came across Lake Superior, I believe, to the Copper Country. And the reason he did that was doubtless because his mother's sister was married to a man named McIntyre, and who was the surface boss at the Quincy mine there. And he came there and was there in high school. Then I understand that he took 2 years at the University of Michigan Medical School, and then took 2 years at the University of Pennsylvania Medical School, where he was a member of the STILLE, I believe that'd be STILLE Medical Society, which I suppose was an honorary society, or it may have been a group of students under this professor gathering for special research or something. I don't know, but I know he was rather proud of having been in that.
Now, this would have been the late 19th century. Was it possible to enter medical school out of high school at that time? Or
I do not know the details of that. I don't know.
But as far as you know, he didn't go to college for 4 years at the University of Michigan and then have those 2 years there.
It is my impression that this was either medical school or a combination of that.
I see. A pro-special program.
After all, I understand that I believe it was in 1900 that the president of the American Medical Society, speaking in his introductory lecture to the meeting of the society, said that so many discoveries had been made in medicine in the previous 10 years that if the next 100 years were spent in studying how to apply these and how they should work out in medicine and so on without any new discoveries, they would consider that they were making great progress. But the 10 years later, which I believe was in 1910, the president of the American Medical Society quoted what the man had said 10 years before, and then went on to say that during these 10 years, more progress in medicine had been made than all that had been known of medicine before 1900, including those advances to which his predecessor had referred.
If
that's the case, it's easy to see that it would take much more time to go through medical school today than it did then.
Sure.
But I understand that sometime, and perhaps not too much long after that, my father did take additional graduate work in medicine at the Johns Hopkins University and at the University of Chicago. So the total that he took might be just as much as the medical students get today. I don't know.
So he studied at four prestigious universities.
Oh, yes.
Why did he transfer, or how did he happen to come to Philadelphia? Was there any family connection, or was that purely the program at the University of Pennsylvania?
I would imagine so. I never heard of any connections in this area at all. I would imagine that he made inquiries as to where he would get the best training, and he wanted the best training. And he had relatives who were able to help him, although how much help they got, I don't know. Because he did tell me once that someone had offered him money to spend a year or two of graduate work in Europe, but he did not feel that he wanted to take on to accept such a big gift. So that how he financed this, I just don't know.
Mm-hmm. Did he take the work at Johns Hopkins and the University of Chicago right after the University of Pennsylvania, or did he go to Michigan?
My impression was that he took it later.
I see.
But I don't know. Mm-hmm. But somebody said he was 23 when he began practicing medicine. Well, you see, that would make 1884, mm-hmm. which is quite a while before I was born.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody said that he was, when he began, that he was that age, but that he looked 17. He was a small one. And that somebody recommended he grow a beard, that he might look older. And it's my, the people he lived with when he was in high school lived there in the copper country. It's rather natural he went back there to do his medical work. And, of course, with these big copper mines, there were a good many accidents, and, of course, people had the normal ills, all these people there. And I believe he was worked as an assistant to some other doctors in connection with the mines. I don't know how long, but sometime in the early 1890s, I believe, perhaps even a little before that, he went to Central Mine, which was quite, they had maybe 200 or 300 homes, I guess. It's quite in the wilderness, situated maybe 6 or 7 miles from Lake Superior. And they put up nice houses there, some of which are in pretty good shape even now. And he was the mine physician there for until the mine closed in 1899. I don't know how long he was there, but I know he used to go back to those reunions and meet many old friends and many people who thought very highly of him. His younger brother, Alec, also became a physician, and he was company physician in the Osceola mine, just a few miles from Centennial. My father, after Central Mine closed, became the physician for the Centennial mine. And then when his brother, as I mentioned, lost his life through an electrical accident, and when I was born in 1902, my father and mother wanted to remember Uncle Alexander, whom they liked so much. But they said, if we call him Alexander, the children will abbreviate it to Alec, and we don't like that abbreviation. So they said, we will name him after Uncle Alan, the man with whom he had lived in Lake Linden. And they said, we like him so much, we're glad to remember him, even if we would have preferred to remember my father's own brother, Alec, but they said, we will give him a middle initial A, and we'll know that stands for Uncle Alec. So that's how I got the A for Alexander.
So your father's uncle, Alan McIntyre.
Yes.
His name was A-L-L-A-N.
Yes.
I see.
He was uncle by marriage.
Right, right.
Yes.
Well, would you like to, you indicated something yesterday which fascinated me, and that was regarding the recording or misrecording of the time of your birth. Would you like to discuss that now, or
when I went to Europe in my early 20s, I had to get a passport, and you had to either get a birth certificate or get somebody who had known you for 20 years. And of course, my father was with me, who had known me more than 20 years. However, I sent for a birth certificate, and when I got it, I found that it had me 1 year older than I was.
It had recorded it as 1901.
1901. See, it was February 11th, 1902, and it was recorded as 1901.
Hmm.
And I thought, oh, what sloppy work they're doing there in that government office.
It would be in
year wrong.
Lansing.
Lansing. Mm-hmm. So I didn't use it at all. I had my father certify as having known me for 20 years, and that was all that was necessary. And then it was, I think sometime later, I'm not sure, when I got another birth certificate and found the same thing. It was 1901. Well, then I went to the office at Houghton of the county, where they had the record of births in the county, and I found they had me recorded as 1901. Not only that, but they had the boy that was lived across the street, whom I played with as a boy, who was born within a couple of weeks at least of me, he was also recorded as 1901. I think what happened was that the physician kept these so he had a bunch of them, and then he turned them in. See, everybody's born home in those days, not in hospitals. And the physician turned them in, and in the county office, they just got them together, you know, and made the date wrong or something on the whole bunch, because that was shortly after 1902 started.
Sure.
And so it got listed as 1901. And then I paid no further attention to it, and when I reached the age of 65, oh, I guess maybe I was 66, I don't know, why a man came to see me from the Social Security, and he said they wanted to give me the record for Medicare, and he asked for when I was born, and I told him it was 1902, but that they had it registered as 1901. And I said, you can certainly find evidence that I was in school from the school records and so on. Well, they found that the school records recorded it exactly as it was, but unfortunately, they started me in school when I was 4. And I was in kindergarten a year and a half, and then the next 3 years they skipped me enough times that I was in just as if I'd started school at 4. So he said, the man came to see me, says, according to your school records, that is it. But he says, the records in the state say 1901, and we have made a determination you were born in 1901. Well, you see, I didn't bother with the Medicare's in two parts. The one that gives you hospitalization, the other you have to pay on to get the doctor's paid. And I didn't take that up for 3 or 4 years later, I guess. I don't know. Anyway, when I did, you had to pay a penalty for not having taken it up when you reached that age. And the penalty for that extra year cost me a little something extra every year since, you see. Put me on a higher basis. And it was some years after that that the thought struck me well, now, why not get to see if there was a newspaper? And I phoned Annabelle Jones, who was in my cousin, second cousin, who was there in Lake Linden, and she went to Houghton, 10 miles away, to the office of the newspaper, and they found a statement about 5 days after I was born in the paper that in Centennial, the home of Dr. John McRae was rejoicing in the presence of a healthy boy. So that was pretty good proof.
Sure.
And my newest passport, I think I've had one for which I presented that, so the passport now is correct, though I don't remember for sure.
Huh.
But
so you got the Medicare straightened out too, and
no,
they,
I didn't.
You don't have to pay as much?
No, I didn't. I've had to pay every year a little more. It's not much in one year, but over the course of years, it comes up.
Hmm. Oh, that's interesting. But your passports do read 1902.
No, I'm not even sure. I got a new one this spring. It's in the next room, but I don't recall.
Uh-huh.
That would be my guess that I did.
That would have been accurate since at the time you did.
I think I did.
Keep after that. Huh. All that, but as far as you know, the records in Lansing and in Houghton still read 1901?
No, she took it. Annabelle took, she took the statement from the newspaper to the county office, and they corrected it. That's right, they corrected it, and then I think I did send to Lansing and got a correct one.
There, too.
That was 10 years ago, 15 years.
So you finally have a birth certificate that your 70s you got one that read the correct birth year of birth.
Yeah.
Well, that's a fascinating anecdote indeed, and one which I had never heard you tell. It's amazing. I've told people, in fact, one of the prime reasons for my enthusiasm about this oral history project with you is that I never cease to tell people that as many times as I've been in your home, as many times I've talked with you over the years and so on, I have never failed to hear fresh and equally fascinating anecdotes and other stories and accounts of things each time.
Well,
it's been amazing. Really a credit to your own recollection and also, of course, to the fabulous life that the Lord has privileged you to live with so many different experiences.
I don't think what I told you last week or yesterday mentioned my father's sense of humor, which I didn't have so much direct contact with, but I remember hearing that he occasionally used to play practical jokes on people. And there was a great big man named Captain Pentecost, who's in the mine. Captain of the Centennial Mine underground, you see. And they were very good friends. And one time he phones Captain Pentecost, and he disguises his voice and he says, "This is the phone company calling. We want to test the reception. Would you please stand about 3 feet back of the phone and say, 'Oh,' and then would you please move now 3 feet to the right and say, 'Ah,' then move 3 feet to the left and say, 'E,' and then stand on your head and say, 'Oh.'" When they said that latter, he knew it was a joke. Another time he and my mother or one time Captain Pentecost phoned my father, and he said, "They're having a good program at Electric Park tonight, and would you like to go? You and Mr. McRae with the two of us." He says, "Fine." So they met, and they got on the train, and Captain Pentecost and my father sat in the seat, and Mrs. Pentecost and my mother sat in the seat behind, and my father saw the two tickets sticking out of the pocket of Captain Pentecost, and he just picks them up and slips them back to my mother in the seat behind. And then when the conductor came through to collect the tickets, he asked for their tickets, and Captain and my father said, well, Captain Pentecost, you got tickets for us, didn't you? And he was rather embarrassed. He says, no, he said, I just got for my wife and myself, he says. And, my father says, you invited us. I thought you would get tickets for us. But Captain Pentecost says, I got the tickets right here. And they weren't there. He looked in three pockets and didn't find them. My father says, oh, don't bother. He says, here, conductor, here's money for our tickets. Eunice, you take care of Mrs. Pentecost. So my mother had the two tickets, and she gave them when the conductor came to them, but my father paid for two tickets here, and he said all the rest of the way there, he was going through his pocket one after the other, hunting for those tickets, and never finding them.
Well, he was a practical joker indeed.
Well, I never saw him do much like that, but I just heard those stories about him. Yeah.
Was that more in his younger days, you think? Than...
Well, I wouldn't have been much younger, because he was 39 when he was married, you see.
Sure.
So that would have been in his 40s at least.
So he practiced medicine for some years then before getting married.
Oh, yes.
Around just after the turn of the century.
He was married in 1901 at the age of 39. And
would you like to discuss that, or do you want to mention something about the people of that area, or start with your mother's background further back, whatever yes. your
Well, maybe pleasure. Just a brief word about the people of the area. It was a copper mining area. And were probably as diversified of people as you would find anywhere in the United States. I believe there were in the immediate vicinity there were 38 different nationalities represented, and they had probably a great many of them were from Cornwall, and they in fact I have seen replicas of advertisements that the mining companies used to put up in Cornwall. Asking for experienced miners to come over from Cornwall, and they had a large number of them there. This Captain Pentecost was one. Walter Scott, in his book Kennelworth, recites the little poem, "By pole, tree, and pen, you may know the Cornishman." And this was Pentecost, and we knew pole glazes and Trebilfox, those three prefixes very often on the Cornish people. And they were a great many miners among them. And they had been known as pirates. There's even stories about there having been a time when they would put lights out to mislead ships so they would be run into the shore and be wrecked so they could plunder them. Now, whether there's any truth to these stories, I don't know. But at the time of the Great Awakening in England, in the 18th century, there was a tremendous turning to the Lord in Cornwall. And the people became known for being very, very loyal, earnest Christians in Cornwall. And most of these people were there. In fact, they were so earnest that the story was told that a woman from some other part of England went to Cornwall and wanted to make a picture of the lake and of the ocean and the shore, and there was a Cornish man, young man who came and watched her, and it made her very nervous having him watch every mark she made, and she kept asking him to go away and leave her, and he wouldn't do it. He insisted on watching her, so finally she just urged him to get away, and he says, I won't move from this spot for an hour. And after he had declared that, she just picked up her pallet and things and moved a few feet back where she, or along where she'd be away from him, and where she could, the view was exactly what it was where she was taking it. And they said that he didn't have a watch, so he stayed there an hour and a half to make sure he hadn't gone back on his word. So they were very... there were very fine people, and there were a great many of them there, up in the copper company when we were there.
they drop their H's a great deal, or they put them in where we don't ordinarily put them in. And people used to make a lot of fun of them for that, but it was all good humored fun. Everybody thought very highly of them. Another group that there were a great many of there were the Finns. There probably was as large a concentration of Finns there as any place in the United States. And in fact, they have a college and theological seminary there in Houghton, which is now quite a fine preparation place, although I fear there's some modernism come into it.
It's a rather small seminary, isn't it? Is that one of the Finnish, smaller Finnish Lutheran bodies?
I believe it is. But when my mother first went up to there, my father said the Finns are a Bible-loving people. And we had a maid who had come over from Finland, and the first thing after she came over, she became a maid in our house, and she was with us for quite a number of years. And then she married a man named Johnson. And when we went up to there 40 years or more after she was married, I guess 50 years after she was married, we visited her daughter. She told us how her mother was living in Detroit then, but the daughter was living there, and she told how the baby when she first came, said it was almost like a first child, and she was always talking about me. And so it was, she came while we were there to visit her daughter, and it was a real treat to see her after all those years. And then they had many, they had all the Scandinavian groups, and we didn't have many French, I don't think. But after we went to California, my father and I went one time to visit an old Frenchman who had lived in the Copper Country. And he said, that was wonderful in the Copper Country. All these different nationalities, and they were all brothers, and there was such a fine relationship between them all. Mm. So it was a nice background to grow up in. And I was glad to have had those experiences with it.
Do you feel that even that background may have contributed to your appreciation for diverse peoples? I know you have always impressed me as a person. This is a kind of a personal aside from the discussion we've been having, but as a person with no pronounced prejudices, but rather a sensitivity to the contributions that different nationalities have made in the Lord's world, so to speak. And
I may have inherited that, because my father, though he had many Scotch qualities, but he always felt that he didn't want